He had been lying in the stubble, but in front of him was the autumn sowing, where the ground was soft. The two borzois of the huntsmen who had sighted him, having been the nearest, were the first to see and pursue him. But they had not gone far before Ilagin's red-spotted Erzab passed them, got within a length, flew at the hare with terrible swiftness, aiming at his scut, and thinking she had seized him, rolled over like a ball. The hare arched his back and bounded off yet more swiftly. From behind Erza rushed the broad-haunched, black-spotted Milka, and began rapidly gaining on the hare. "Milashka, dear!" rose Nicholas's triumphant cry. It looked as if Milka would immediately pounce on the hare, but she overtook him and flew past. The hare had squatted. Again the beautiful Erza reached him, but when close to the hare's scut, paused as if measuring the distance, so as not to make a mistake this time, but seize his hind leg. "Erza, darling!" Ilagin wailed in a voice unlike his own. Erza did not hearken to his appeal. At the very moment when she would have seized her prey, the hare moved and darted along the balk between the winter rye and the stubble. Again Erza and Milka were abreast, running like a pair of carriage horses, and began to overtake the hare. But it was easier for the hare to run on the balk, and the borzois did not overtake him so quickly.
"Rugai! Rugayushka! That's it, come on!" came a third voice just then,
and Uncle's red borzoi, straining and curving its back, caught up with the two foremost borzois, pushed ahead of them regardless of the terrible strain, put on speed close to the hare, knocked it off the balk onto the rye field, again put on speed still more viciously, sinking to his knees in the muddy field, and all one could see was how, muddying his back, he rolled over with the hare. A ring of borzois surrounded him. A moment later, everyone had drawn up round the crowd of dogs. Only the delighted uncle dismounted and cut off a pad, shaking the hare for the blood to drip off, and anxiously glancing round with restless eyes while his arms and legs twitched. He spoke without himself knowing whom to or what about.
"That's it, come on, that's a dog. There it has beaten them all, the 1,000 ruble as well as the 1 ruble borzois. That's it, come on," said he, panting, and looking wrathfully around as if he were abusing someone,
as if they were all his enemies and had insulted him, and only now had he at last succeeded in justifying himself.
"There are your 1,000 ruble ones. That's it, come on. Rugai, here's a pad for you," he said, throwing down the hare's muddy pad. "You've deserved it. That's it, come on."
"She'd tired herself out. She'd run it down 3 times by herself," said Nicholas, also not listening to anyone, and regardless of whether he were heard or not. "But what is there in running across it like that?" said Ilagin's groom.
"Once she had missed it and turned it away, any mongrel could take it," Ilagin was saying at the same time, breathless from his gallop and his excitement.
At the same moment, Natasha, without drawing breath, screamed joyously, ecstatically, and so piercingly that it set everyone's ear tingling. By that shriek, she expressed what the others expressed by all talking at once. And it was so strange that she must herself have been ashamed of so wild a cry, and everyone else would have been amazed at it at any other time. Uncle himself twisted up the hare, threw it neatly and smartly across his horse's back, as if by that gesture he meant to rebuke everybody, and with an air of not wishing to speak to anyone, mounted his bay and rode off. The others all followed, dispirited and shamefaced, and only much later were they able to regain their former affectation of indifference. For a long time they continued to look at Red Rugai, who, his arched back spattered with mud and clanking the ring of his leash, walked along just behind Uncle's horse with the serene air of a conqueror. "Well, I'm like any other dog, as long as it's not a question of coursing, but when it is, then look out," his appearance seemed to Nicholas to be saying. When much later Uncle rode up to Nicholas and began talking to him, he felt flattered that, after what had happened, Uncle deigned to speak to him. Chapter 7. An Evening at Uncle's. The Balalaika. Natasha's Russian Dance. Toward evening, Ilagin took leave of Nicholas, who found they were so far from home that he accepted Uncle's offer that the hunting party should spend the night in his little village of Mikhailovna.
"And if you put up at my house, that will be better still. That's it, come on," said Uncle. "You see, it's damp weather, and you could rest, and the little countess could be driven home in a trap."
Uncle's offer was accepted, A huntsman was sent to Otrádnoye for a trap, while Nicholas rode with Natasha and Petya to Uncle's house. Some 5 male domestic serfs, big and little, rushed out to the front porch to meet their master. A score of women serfs, old and young, as well as children, popped out from the back entrance to have a look at the hunters who were arriving. The presence of Natasha, a woman, a lady, and on horseback, raised the curiosity of the serfs to such a degree that many of them came up to her, stared her in the face, and, unabashed by her presence, made remarks about her as though she was some prodigy on show, and not a human being able to hear or understand what was said about her.
"Arinka, look! She sits sideways. There she sits, and her skirt dangles. See, she's got a little hunting horn. Goodness gracious! See her knife?
Isn't she a Tartar?
How is it you didn't go head over heels?"
asked the boldest of all, addressing Natasha directly. Uncle dismounted at the porch of his little wooden house, which stood in the midst of an overgrown garden, and, after a glance at his retainers, shouted authoritatively that the superfluous ones should take themselves off, and that all necessary preparations should be made to receive the guests and the visitors. The serfs all dispersed. Uncle lifted Natasha off her horse, and, taking her hand, led her up the rickety wooden steps of the porch. The house, with its bare, unplastered log walls, was not over-clean. It did not seem that those living in it aimed at keeping it spotless, but neither was it noticeably neglected. In the entry there was a smell of fresh apples, and wolf and fox skins hung about. Uncle led the visitors through the anteroom into a small hall with a folding table and red chairs, then into the drawing room with a round birchwood table and a sofa, and finally into his private room, where there was a tattered sofa, a worn carpet, and portraits of Suvorov, of the host's father and mother, and of himself in military uniform. The study smelt strongly of tobacco and dogs. Uncle asked his visitors to sit down and make themselves at home, and then went out of the room. Rugai, his back still muddy, came into the room and lay down on the sofa, cleaning himself with his tongue and teeth. Leading from the study was a passage in which a partition with ragged curtains could be seen. From behind this came women's laughter and whispers. Natasha, Nicholas, and Petya took off their wraps and sat down on the sofa. Petya, leaning on his elbow, fell asleep at once. Natasha and Nicholas were silent. Their faces glowed. They were hungry and very cheerful. They looked at one another. Now that the hunt was over and they were in the house, Nicholas no longer considered it necessary to show his manly superiority over his sister. Natasha gave him a wink, and neither refrained long from bursting into a peal of ringing laughter, even before they had a pretext ready to account for it. After a while, Uncle came in a Cossack coat, blue trousers, and small top boots, and Natasha felt that this costume, the very one she had regarded with surprise and amusement at Otrádnoye, was just the right thing, and not at all worse than a swallow-tail or frock-coat. Uncle, too, was in high spirits, and far from being offended by the brothers and sisters' laughter, it could never enter his head that they might be laughing at his way of life, he himself joined in the merriment.
"That's right, young countess, that's it, come on. I never saw anyone like her," said he, offering Nicholas a pipe with a long stem, and with a practiced motion of 3 fingers taking down another that had been cut short. "She's ridden all day like a man, and is as fresh as ever."
Soon after Uncle's reappearance, the door was opened, evidently from the sound, by a barefooted girl, and a stout, rosy, good-looking woman of about 40, with a double chin and full red lips, entered carrying a large loaded tray. With hospitable dignity and cordiality in her glance and in every motion, she looked at the visitors, and with a pleasant smile bowed respectfully. In spite of her exceptional stoutness, which caused her to protrude her chest and stomach and throw back her head, this woman, who was Uncle's housekeeper, trod very lightly. She went to the table, set down the tray, and with her plump white hands deftly took from it the bottles and various hors d'oeuvres and dishes and arranged them on the table. When she had finished, she stepped aside and stopped at the door with a smile on her face. "Here I am. I am she. Now do you understand, Uncle?" her expression said to Rostov. How could one help understanding? Not only Nicholas, but even Natasha understood the meaning of his puckered brow and the happy, complacent smile that slightly puckered his lips when Anisya Fyodorovna entered. On the tray was a bottle of herb wine, different kinds of vodka, pickled mushrooms, rye cakes made with buttermilk, honey in the comb, still mead and sparkling mead, apples, nuts, raw and roasted, and nut and honey sweets. Afterwards she brought a freshly roasted chicken, ham, preserves made with honey, and preserves made with sugar. All this was the fruit of Anisya Fyodorovna's housekeeping, gathered and prepared by her. The smell and taste of it all had a smack of Anisya Fyodorovna herself, a savor of juiciness, cleanliness, whiteness, and pleasant smiles. "Take this, little lady countess," she kept saying as she offered Natasha first one thing and then another. Natasha ate of everything and thought she had never seen or eaten such buttermilk cakes, such aromatic jam, such honey and nut sweets, or such a chicken anywhere. Anisya Fyodorovna left the room. After supper, over their cherry brandy, Rostov and Uncle talked of past and future hunts, of Rugai and Ilagin's dogs, while Natasha sat upright on the sofa and listened with sparkling eyes. She tried several times to wake Petya that he might eat something, but he only muttered incoherent words without waking up. Natasha felt so light-hearted and happy in these novel surroundings that she only feared the trap would come for her too soon. After a casual pause, such as often occurs when receiving friends for the first time in one's own house, Uncle, answering a thought that was in his visitor's mind, said, "This, you see, is how I'm finishing my days. Death will come. That's it. Come on. Nothing will remain. Then why harm anyone?" Uncle's face was very significant and even handsome as he said this. Involuntarily, Rostov recalled all the good he had heard about him from his father and the neighbors. Throughout the whole province, Uncle had the reputation of being the most honorable and disinterested of cranks. They called him in to decide family disputes, chose him as executor, confided secrets to him, elected him to be a justice and to other posts. But he always persistently refused public appointments, passing the autumn and spring in the fields on his bay gelding, sitting at home in winter, and lying in his overgrown garden in summer. "Why don't you enter the service, Uncle?"
"I did once, but gave it up. I'm not fit for it. That's it. Come on. I can't make head or tail of it. That's for you. I haven't brains enough. Now, hunting is another matter. That's it. Come on. Open the door there," he shouted. "Why have you shut it?"
The door at the end of the passage led to the huntsman's room, as they called the room for the hunt servants. There was a rapid patter of bare feet, and an unseen hand opened the door into the huntsman's room, from which came the clear sounds of a balalaika, on which someone, who was evidently a master of the art, was playing. Natasha had been listening to those strains for some time, and now went out into the passage to hear better.
"That's Mitka, my coachman. I've got him a good balalaika. I'm fond of it," said Uncle.
It was the custom for Mitka to play the balalaika in the huntsman's room when Uncle returned from the chase. Uncle was fond of such music.
"How good. Really very good," said Nicholas, with some unintentional superciliousness, as if ashamed to confess that the sounds pleased him very much.
"Very good," said Natasha reproachfully, noticing her brother's tone. "Not very good. It's simply delicious." Just as Uncle's pickled mushrooms, honey, and cherry brandy had seemed to her the best in the world, so also that song at that moment seemed to her the acme of musical delight.
"More, please, more," cried Natasha at the door as soon as the balalaika ceased.
Mitka tuned up afresh and recommenced thrumming the balalaika to the air of My Lady, with trills and variations. Uncle sat listening, slightly smiling, with his head on one side. The air was repeated 100 times. The balalaika was retuned several times, and the same notes were thrummed again. But the listeners did not grow weary of it, and wished to hear it again and again. Anisya Fyodorovna came in and leaned her portly person against the doorpost. "You like listening?" she said to Natasha, with a smile extremely like Uncle's. "That's a good player of ours," she added.
"He doesn't play that part right," said Uncle suddenly with an energetic gesture. "Here he ought to burst out. That's it, come on. Ought to burst out."
"Do you play then?" asked Natasha. Uncle did not answer, but smiled.
"Anisya, go and see if the strings of my guitar are all right." I haven't touched it for a long time. That's it, come on. I've given it up.
Anisya Fyodorovna, with her light step, willingly went to fulfill her errand and brought back the guitar. Without looking at anyone, Uncle blew the dust off it, and tapping the case with his bony fingers, tuned the guitar and settled himself in his armchair. He took the guitar a little above the fingerboard, arching his left elbow with a somewhat theatrical gesture, and with a wink at Anisya Fyodorovna, struck a single chord, pure and sonorous, and then quietly, smoothly, and confidently began playing in very slow time, not My Lady, but the well-known song Came a Maiden Down the Street. The tune, played with precision and in exact time, began to thrill in the hearts of Nicholas and Natasha, arousing in them the same kind of sober mirth as radiated from Anisya Fyodorovna's whole being. Anisya Fyodorovna flushed, and, drawing her kerchief over her face, went laughing out of the room. Uncle continued to play correctly, carefully, with energetic firmness, looking with a changed and inspired expression at the spot where Anisya Fyodorovna had just stood. Something seemed to be laughing a little on one side of his face under his gray mustaches, especially as the song grew brisker and the time quicker, and when here and there, as he ran his fingers over the strings, something seemed to snap.
"Lovely, lovely! Go on, Uncle, go on!" shouted Natasha as soon as he had finished. She jumped up and hugged and kissed him. "Nicholas, Nicholas," she said, turning to her brother, as if asking him, "What is it that moves me so?"
Nicholas, too, was greatly pleased by Uncle's playing, and Uncle played the piece over again. Anisya Fyodorovna's smiling face reappeared in the doorway, and behind hers other faces. "Fetching water clear and sweet, stop, dear maiden, I entreat," played Uncle once more, running his fingers skillfully over the strings. And then he stopped short and jerked his shoulders.
"Go on, Uncle dear," Natasha wailed in an imploring tone as if her life depended on it.
Uncle rose, and it was as if there were two men in him. One of them smiled seriously at the merry fellow, while the merry fellow struck a naive and precise attitude preparatory to a folk dance.
"Now then, niece," he exclaimed, waving to Natasha the hand that had just struck a chord.
Natasha threw off the shawl from her shoulders, ran forward to face Uncle, and setting her arms akimbo, also made a motion with her shoulders and struck an attitude. Where, how, and when had this young countess, educated by an émigré French governess, imbibed from the Russian air she breathed that spirit, and obtained that manner which the pas de châle would, one would have supposed, long ago have effaced? Note, the pas de châle is the shawl dance, a French dance, the style of which contrasts with the Russian folk dances. But the spirit and the movements were those inimitable and unteachable Russian ones that Uncle had expected of her. As soon as she had struck her pose and smiled triumphantly, proudly, and with sly merriment, the fear that had at first seized Nicholas and the others that she might not do the right thing was at an end, and they were already admiring her. She did the right thing with such precision, such complete precision, that Anisya Fyodorovna, who had at once handed her the handkerchief she needed for the dance, had tears in her eyes, though she laughed as she watched this slim, graceful countess, reared in silks and velvets and so different from herself, who yet was able to understand all that was in Anisya, and in Anisya's father and mother and aunt, and in every Russian man and woman.
"Well, little countess, that's it, come on," cried Uncle with a joyous laugh, having finished the dance. "Well done, niece. Now a fine young fellow must be found as husband for you. That's it, come on."
"He's chosen already," said Nicholas, smiling.
"Oh?"
said Uncle in surprise, looking inquiringly at Natasha, who nodded her head with a happy smile.
"And such a one," she said.
But as soon as she had said it, a new train of thoughts and feelings arose in her. What did Nicholas's smile mean when he said, "chosen already"? Is he glad of it or not? It is as if he thought my Bolkonski would not approve of or understand our gaiety. But he would understand it all. Where is he now? She thought, and her face suddenly became serious. But this lasted only a second. Don't dare to think about it, she said to herself, and sat down again smilingly beside Uncle, begging him to play something more. Uncle played another song, and a valse. Then, after a pause, he cleared his throat
and sang his favorite hunting song. As 'twas growing dark last night, fell the snow so soft and light. Uncle sang as peasants sing, with full and naive conviction that the whole meaning of a song lies in the words, and that the tune comes of itself, and that apart from the words there is no tune, which exists only to give measure to the words. As a result of this, the unconsidered tune, like the song of a bird, was extraordinarily good. Natasha was in ecstasies over Uncle's singing. She resolved to give up learning the harp and to play only the guitar. She asked Uncle for his guitar and at once found the chords of the song. After 9 o'clock, 2 traps and 3 mounted men who had been sent to look for them arrived to fetch Natasha and Petya. The Count and Countess did not know where they were and were very anxious, said one of the men. Petya was carried out like a log and laid in the larger of the 2 traps. Natasha and Nicholas got into the other. Uncle wrapped Natasha up warmly and took leave of her with quite a new tenderness. He accompanied them on foot as far as the bridge that could not be crossed, so that they had to go round by the ford, and he sent huntsmen to ride in front with lanterns.
"Goodbye, dear niece,"
his voice called out of the darkness, not the voice Natasha had known previously, but the one that had sung, "As 'twas growing dark last night." In the village through which they passed, there were red lights and a cheerful smell of smoke. "What a darling Uncle is," said Natasha, when they had come out onto the high road. "Yes," returned Nicholas. "You're not cold?" "No, I'm quite all right." "I feel so comfortable," answered Natasha, almost perplexed by her feelings. They remained silent a long while. The night was dark and damp. They could not see the horses, but only heard them splashing through the unseen mud. What was passing in that receptive, childlike soul that so eagerly caught and assimilated all the diverse impressions of life? How did they all find place in her? But she was very happy. As they were nearing home, she suddenly struck up the air of "As 'Twas Growing Dark Last Night," the tune of which she had all the way been trying to get and had at last caught. "Got it?" said Nicholas. "What were you thinking about just now, Nicholas?" inquired Natasha. They were fond of asking one another that question. "I?" said Nicholas, trying to remember. "Well, you see, first I thought that Rugai, the red hound, was like Uncle, and that if he were a man, he would always keep Uncle near him, if not for his riding, then for his manner. What a good fellow Uncle is, don't you think so? Well, and you?"
"I? Wait a bit, wait. Yes. First I thought that we were driving along and imagining that we're going home, but that heaven knows where we're really going in the darkness, and that we shall arrive and suddenly find that we're not in Otradnoye, but in Fairyland. And then I thought... No, nothing else."
"I know. I expect you thought of him," said Nicholas, smiling as Natasha knew by the sound of his voice.
"No," said Natasha, though she had in reality been thinking about Prince Andrew at the same time as of the rest, and of how he would have liked Uncle. "And then I was saying to myself all the way, how well Anicia carried herself, how well."
And Nicholas heard her spontaneous, happy, ringing laughter.
"Then do you know," she suddenly said, "I know that I shall never again be as happy and tranquil as I am now."
"Rubbish, nonsense, humbug," exclaimed Nicholas. And he thought, "How charming this Natasha of mine is. I have no other friend like her. I never shall have. Why should she marry? We might always drive about together." "What a darling this Nicholas of mine is," thought Natasha.
"Ah, there are still lights in the drawing room," she said, pointing to the windows of the house that gleamed invitingly in the moist, velvety darkness of the night.
Chapter 8. His mother urges Nicholas to marry Julie Karagina and grumbles at Sonya. Count Ilya Rostov had resigned the position of Marshal of the Nobility because it involved him in too much expense. But still his affairs did not improve. Natasha and Nicholas often noticed their parents conferring together anxiously and privately, and heard suggestions of selling the fine ancestral Rostov house and estate near Moscow. It was not necessary to entertain so freely as when the Count had been marshal, and life at Otradnoye was quieter than in former years, but still the enormous house and its lodges were full of people, and more than 20 sat down to table every day. These were all their own people who had settled down in the house almost as members of the family, or persons who were, it seemed, obliged to live in the Count's house. Such were Dimmler the musician and his wife, Vogel the dancing master and his family, Bielova, an old maiden lady, an inmate of the house, and many others, such as Petya's tutors, the girl's former governess, and other people who simply found it preferable and more advantageous to live in the Count's house than at home. They had not as many visitors as before, but the old habits of life, without which the Count and Countess could not conceive of existence, remained unchanged. There was still the hunting establishment, which Nicholas had even enlarged, the same 50 horses and 15 grooms in the stables, the same expensive presents and dinner parties to the whole district on name days. There were still the Count's games of whist and Boston, at which, spreading out his cards so that everybody could see them, he let himself be plundered of hundreds of rubles every day by his neighbors, who looked upon an opportunity to play a rubber with Count Rostov as a most profitable source of income. The Count moved in his affairs as in a huge net, trying not to believe that he was entangled, but becoming more and more so at every step, and feeling too feeble to break the meshes or to set to work carefully and patiently to disentangle them. The Countess, with her loving heart, felt that her children were being ruined, that it was not the Count's fault, for he could not help being what he was, that, though he tried to hide it, he himself suffered from the consciousness of his own and his children's ruin, and she tried to find means of remedying the position. From her feminine point of view, she could see only one solution, namely, for Nicholas to marry a rich heiress. She felt this to be their last hope, and that if Nicholas refused the match she had found for him, she would have to abandon the hope of ever getting matters right. This match was with Julie Karagina, the daughter of excellent and virtuous parents, a girl the Rostovs had known from childhood, and who had now become a wealthy heiress through the death of the last of her brothers. The Countess had written direct to Julie's mother in Moscow suggesting a marriage between their children, and had received a favorable answer from her. Karagina had replied that, for her part, she was agreeable, and everything would depend on her daughter's inclination. She invited Nicholas to come to Moscow. Several times the Countess, with tears in her eyes, told her son that, now both her daughters were settled, her only wish was to see him married. She said she could lie down in her grave peacefully if that were accomplished. Then she told him that she knew of a splendid girl, and tried to discover what he thought about marriage. At other times she praised Julie to him and advised him to go to Moscow during the holidays to amuse himself. Nicholas guessed what his mother's remarks were leading to, and during one of these conversations induced her to speak quite frankly. She told him that her only hope of getting their affairs disentangled now lay in his marrying Julie Karagina. "But, Mama, suppose I loved a girl who has no fortune. Would you expect me to sacrifice my feelings and my honor for the sake of money?" he asked his mother, not realizing the cruelty of his question, and only wishing to show his noble-mindedness. "No, you've not understood me," said his mother, not knowing how to justify herself. "You've not understood me, Nikolenka. It is your happiness I wish for," she added, feeling that she was telling an untruth and was becoming entangled. She began to cry. "Oh, Mama, don't cry. Only tell me that you wish it, and you know I will give my life anything to put you at ease," said Nicholas. "I would sacrifice anything for you, even my feelings." But the Countess did not want the question put like that. She did not want a sacrifice from her son. She herself wished to make a sacrifice for him. "No, you've not understood me. Don't let us talk about it," she replied, wiping away her tears. "Maybe I do love a poor girl," said Nicholas to himself. "Am I to sacrifice my feelings and my honor for money? I wonder how Mama could speak so to me. Because Sonya is poor, I must not love her," he thought, "must not respond to her faithful, devoted love. Yet I should certainly be happier with her than with some doll like Julie. I can always sacrifice my feelings for my family's welfare," he said to himself, "but I can't coerce my feelings. If I love Sonia, that feeling is for me stronger and higher than all else. Nicholas did not go to Moscow, and the Countess did not renew the conversation with him about marriage. She saw with sorrow, and sometimes with exasperation, symptoms of a growing attachment between her son and the portionless Sonia. Though she blamed herself for it, she could not refrain from grumbling at and worrying Sonia, often pulling her up without reason, addressing her stiffly as "my dear," and using the formal "you" instead of the intimate "thou" in speaking to her. The kind-hearted Countess was the more vexed with Sonia because that poor dark-eyed niece of hers was so meek, so kind, so devotedly grateful to her benefactors, and so faithfully, unchangingly, and unselfishly in love with Nicholas, that there were no grounds for finding fault with her. Nicholas was spending the last of his leave at home. A fourth letter had come from Prince Andrew from Rome, in which he wrote that he would have been on his way back to Russia long ago had not his wound unexpectedly reopened in the warm climate, which obliged him to defer his return till the beginning of the new year. Natasha was still as much in love with her betrothed, found the same comfort in that love, and was still as ready to throw herself into all the pleasures of life as before. But at the end of the fourth month of their separation, she began to have fits of depression which she could not master. She felt sorry for herself, sorry that she was being wasted all this time and of no use to anyone, while she felt herself so capable of loving and being loved. Things were not cheerful in the Rostovs' home. Chapter 9. Christmas at Otradnoye. Natasha is depressed and capricious. Christmas came, and except for the ceremonial mass, the solemn and wearisome Christmas congratulations from neighbors and servants, and the new dresses everyone put on, there were no special festivities, though the calm frost of 20 degrees Réaumur, the dazzling sunshine by day, and the starlight of the winter nights seemed to call for some special celebration of the season. Note, 20 degrees Réaumur is 13 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit. On the third day of Christmas week, after the midday dinner, all the inmates of the house dispersed to various rooms. It was the dullest time of the day. Nicholas, who had been visiting some neighbors that morning, was asleep on the sitting-room sofa. The old count was resting in his study. Sonia sat in the drawing-room at the round table, copying a design for embroidery. The countess was playing patience. Nastasya Ivanovna, the buffoon, sat with a sad face at the window with two old ladies. Natasha came into the room, went up to Sonia, glanced at what she was doing, and then went up to her mother and stood without speaking. "Why are you wandering about like an outcast?" asked her mother. "What do you want?"
"Him. I want him. Now, this minute. I want him," said Natasha, with glittering eyes and no sign of a smile.
The countess lifted her head and looked attentively at her daughter.
"Don't look at me, Mama. Don't look. I shall cry directly."
"Sit down with me a little," said the countess.
"Mama, I want him. Why should I be wasted like this, Mama?"
Her voice broke, tears gushed from her eyes, and she turned quickly to hide them and left the room. She passed into the sitting room, stood there thinking a while, and then went into the maid's room. There an old maidservant was grumbling at a young girl who stood panting, having just run in through the cold from the serfs' quarters.
"Stop playing. There's a time for everything," said the old woman.
"Let her alone, Kondratyevna," said Natasha. "Go, Mavrusha, go." Having released Mavrushka, Natasha crossed the dancing hall and went to the vestibule. There an old footman and two young ones were playing cards. They broke off and rose as she entered. "Oh, what can I do with them?" thought Natasha.
"Oh, Nikita, please go. Where can I send him? Yes, go to the yard and fetch a fowl, please, a cock. And you, Misha, bring me some oats."
"Just a few oats," said Misha, cheerfully and readily. "Go, go quickly," the old man urged him.
"And you, Theodore, get me a piece of chalk."
Note, feeding a fowl with grain arranged on the floor is a way of telling fortunes at Christmas time. On her way past the butler's pantry, she told them to set a samovar, though it was not at all the time for tea. Foka, the butler, was the most ill-tempered person in the house. Natasha liked to test her power over him. He distrusted the order and asked whether the samovar was really wanted. "Oh, dear, what a young lady," said Foka, pretending to frown at Natasha. No one in the house sent people about or gave them as much trouble as Natasha did. She could not see people unconcernedly, but had to send them on some errand. She seemed to be trying whether any of them would get angry or sulky with her. But the serfs fulfilled no one's orders so readily as they did hers. "What can I do? Where can I go?" thought she as she went slowly along the passage. "Nastasya Ivanovna, what sort of children shall I have?" she asked the buffoon, who was coming toward her in a woman's jacket. "Why, fleas, crickets, grasshoppers," answered the buffoon. "Oh, Lord, it's always the same. Oh, where am I to go? What am I to do with myself?" And tapping with her heels, she ran quickly upstairs to see Vogel and his wife, who lived on the upper story. Two governesses were sitting with the Vogels at a table on which were plates of raisins, walnuts, and almonds. The governesses were discussing whether it was cheaper to live in Moscow or Odessa. Natasha sat down, listened to their talk with a serious and thoughtful air, and then got up again. "The island of Madagascar," she said. "Madagascar," she repeated, articulating each syllable distinctly. And not replying to Madame Schoss, who asked her what she was saying, she went out of the room. Her brother Petya was upstairs, too. With the man in attendance on him, he was preparing fireworks to let off that night. "Petya, Petya," she called to him, "carry me downstairs." Petya ran up and offered her his back. She jumped on it, putting her arms round his neck, and he pranced along with her. "No, don't. The island of Madagascar," she said, and jumping off his back, she went downstairs. Having, as it were, reviewed her kingdom, tested her power, and made sure that everyone was submissive, but that all the same it was dull, Natasha betook herself to the ballroom, picked up her guitar, sat down in a dark corner behind a bookcase, and began to run her fingers over the strings in the bass, picking out a passage she recalled from an opera she had heard in Petersburg with Prince Andrew. What she drew from the guitar would have had no meaning for other listeners, but in her imagination, a whole series of reminiscences arose from those sounds. She sat behind the bookcase, with her eyes fixed on a streak of light escaping from the pantry door, and listened to herself and pondered. She was in a mood for brooding on the past. Sonya passed to the pantry with a glass in her hand. Natasha glanced at her and at the crack in the pantry door, and it seemed to her that she remembered the light falling through that crack once before, and Sonya passing with a glass in her hand. Yes, it was exactly the same, thought Natasha. "Sonya, what is this?" she cried, twanging a thick string. "Oh, you were there," said Sonya with a start, and came near and listened. "I don't know. A storm?" she ventured timidly, afraid of being wrong. "There, that's just how she started, and just how she came up smiling timidly when all this happened before," thought Natasha. "And in just the same way, I thought there was something lacking in her." "No, it's the chorus from The Water Carrier. Listen." And Natasha sang the air of the chorus so that Sonya should catch it. "Where are you going?" she asked. "To change the water in this glass. I'm just finishing the design." "You always find something to do, but I can't," said Natasha. "And where's Nicholas?" "Asleep, I think." "Sonya, go and wake him," said Natasha. "Tell him I want him to come and sing." She sat a while, wondering what the meaning of it all having happened before could be, and without solving this problem, or at all regretting not having done so, she again passed in fancy to the time when she was with him, and he was looking at her with a lover's eyes. "Oh, if only he would come quicker. I'm so afraid it will never be. And worst of all, I'm growing old. That's the thing. There won't then be in me what there is now. But perhaps he'll come today. Will come immediately. Perhaps he has come and is sitting in the drawing room. Perhaps he came yesterday and I've forgotten it." She rose, put down the guitar, and went to the drawing room. All the domestic circle, tutors, governesses, and guests, were already at the tea table. The servants stood round the table, but Prince Andrew was not there, and life was going on as before. "Ah, here she is," said the old count when he saw Natasha enter.
Well, sit down by me. But Natasha stayed by her mother and glanced round as if looking for something. Mama, she muttered, give him to me. Give him, Mama, quickly. Quickly. And she again had difficulty in repressing her sobs. She sat down at the table and listened to the conversation between the elders and Nicholas, who had also come to the table. My God, the same faces, the same talk, Papa holding his cup and blowing in the same way, thought Natasha, feeling with horror a sense of repulsion rising up in her for the whole household, because they were always the same. After tea, Nicholas, Sonya, and Natasha went to the sitting room, to their favorite corner, where their most intimate talks always began. Chapter 10. Nicholas, Natasha, and Sonya indulge in recollections. Dimmler plays and Natasha sings. The Maskers. A troika drive to the Melyukovs. Does it ever happen to you, said Natasha to her brother when they settled down in the sitting room, does it ever happen to you to feel as if there were nothing more to come, nothing, that everything good is past, and to feel not exactly dull, but sad? I should think so, he replied. I felt like that when everything was all right and everyone was cheerful. The thought has come into my mind that I was already tired of it all, and that we must all die. Once in the regiment, I'd not gone to some merrymaking where there was music, and suddenly I felt so depressed. Oh, yes, I know, Natasha interrupted him. When I was quite little, that used to be so with me. Do you remember when I was punished once about some plums? You were all dancing, and I sat sobbing in the schoolroom. I shall never forget it. I felt sad and sorry for everyone, for myself and for everyone. And I was innocent. That was the chief thing, said Natasha. Do you remember? I remember, answered Nicholas. I remember that I came to you afterwards and wanted to comfort you, but, you know, I felt ashamed, too. We were terribly absurd. I had a funny doll then and wanted to give it to you. Do you remember? And do you remember, Natasha asked with a pensive smile, how once, long, long ago, when we were quite little, Uncle called us into the study, that was in the old house, and it was dark. We went in, and suddenly there stood a Negro, chimed in Nicholas with a smile of delight. Of course, I remember. Even now, I don't know whether there really was a Negro, if we only dreamed it or were told about it. He was gray, you remember, and had white teeth, and stood and looked at us. Sonya, do you remember? Asked Nicholas. Yes, I do remember something, too, Sonya answered timidly. You know, I've asked Papa and Mama about that Negro, said Natasha, and they say there was no Negro at all. But you see, you remember. Of course I do. I remember his teeth as if I'd just seen them. How strange it is. It's as if it were a dream. I like that. And do you remember how we rolled hard-boiled eggs in the ballroom, and suddenly two old women began spinning round on the carpet? Was that real or not? Do you remember what fun it was? Yes. You remember how Papa in his blue overcoat fired a gun in the porch? So they went through their memories, smiling with pleasure. Not the sad memories of old age, but poetic, youthful ones. Those impressions of one's most distant past in which dreams and realities blend. And they laughed with quiet enjoyment. Sonya, as always, did not quite keep pace with them, though they shared the same reminiscences. Much that they remembered had slipped from her mind, and what she recalled did not arouse the same poetic feeling as they experienced. She simply enjoyed their pleasure and tried to fit in with it. She only really took part when they recalled Sonya's first arrival. She told them how afraid she had been of Nicholas because he had on a corded jacket, and her nurse had told her that she, too, would be sewn up with cords. "And I remember their telling me that you'd been born under a cabbage," said Natasha. "And I remember that I dared not disbelieve it then, but knew that it was not true, and I felt so uncomfortable." While they were talking, a maid thrust her head in at the other door of the sitting room. "They brought the cock, miss," she said in a whisper. "It isn't wanted, Polya. Tell them to take it away," replied Natasha. In the middle of their talk in the sitting room, Dimmler came in and went up to the harp that stood there in a corner. He took off its cloth covering
and the harp gave out a jarring sound.
Mr. Dimmler, please play my favorite nocturne by Field,
came the old countess's voice from the drawing room. Dimmler struck a chord, and turning to Natasha, Nicholas, and Sonya, remarked, How quiet you young people are. Yes, we're philosophizing, said Natasha, glancing round for a moment and then continuing the conversation. They were now discussing dreams. Dimmler began to play. Natasha went on tiptoe noiselessly to the table, took up a candle, carried it out, and returned, seating herself quietly in her former place. It was dark in the room, especially where they were sitting on the sofa, but through the big windows the silvery light of the full moon fell on the floor. Dimmler had finished the piece, but still sat softly running his fingers over the strings, evidently uncertain whether to stop or to play something else. "Do you know," said Natasha in a whisper, moving closer to Nicholas and Sonya, "that when one goes on and on recalling memories, one at last begins to remember what happened before one was in the world?" "That is metempsychosis," said Sonya, who had always learned well and remembered everything. "The Egyptians believed that our souls have lived in animals and will go back into animals again." "No, I don't believe we ever were in animals," said Natasha, still in a whisper, though the music had ceased. "But I'm certain that we were angels somewhere there and have been here, and that is why we remember." "May I join you?" said Dimmler, who had come up quietly, and he sat down by them. "If we've been angels, why have we fallen lower?" said Nicholas. "No, that can't be."
"Not lower? Who said we were lower? How do I know what I was before?" Natasha rejoined with conviction. "The soul is immortal. Well, then, if I shall always live, I must have lived before, lived for a whole eternity."
"Yes, but it is hard for us to imagine eternity," remarked Dimmler, who had joined the young folk with a mildly condescending smile, but now spoke as quietly and seriously as they.
"Why is it hard to imagine eternity?" said Natasha. "It is now today, and it will be tomorrow, and always. And there was yesterday, and the day before."
"Natasha, now it's your turn. Sing me something," they heard the countess say. "Why are you sitting there like conspirators?"
"Mama, I don't at all want to," replied Natasha. But all the same, she rose. None of them, not even the middle-aged Dimmler, wanted to break off their conversation and quit that corner in the sitting room. But Natasha got up, and Nicholas sat down at the clavichord. Standing as usual in the middle of the hall and choosing the place where the resonance was best, Natasha began to sing her mother's favorite song. She had said she did not want to sing, but it was long since she had sung, and long before she again sang as she did that evening. The count, from his study where he was talking to Mityanka, heard her, and like a schoolboy in a hurry to run out to play, blundered in his talk while giving orders to the steward, and at last stopped while Mityanka stood in front of him also listening and smiling. Nicholas did not take his eyes off his sister and drew breath in time with her. Sonya, as she listened, thought of the immense difference there was between herself and her friend, and how impossible it was for her to be anything like as bewitching as her cousin. The old countess sat with a blissful yet sad smile and with tears in her eyes, occasionally shaking her head. She thought of Natasha and of her own youth and of how there was something unnatural and dreadful in this impending marriage of Natasha and Prince Andrew. Dimmler, who had seated himself beside the countess, listened with closed eyes. "Ah, countess," he said at last, "that's a European talent. She has nothing to learn. What softness, tenderness, and strength." "Oh, how afraid I am for her, how afraid I am," said the countess, not realizing to whom she was speaking. Her maternal instinct told her that Natasha had too much of something, and that because of this she would not be happy. Before Natasha had finished singing, 14-year-old Petya rushed in delightedly to say that some mummers had arrived. Natasha stopped abruptly. "Idiot!" she screamed at her brother, and running to a chair, threw herself on it, sobbing so violently that she could not stop for a long time. It's nothing, Mama, really, it's nothing. Only Petya startled me, she said, trying to smile. But her tears still flowed, and sobs still choked her. The mummers, some of the house serfs, dressed up as bears, Turks, innkeepers, and ladies, frightening and funny, bringing in with them the cold from outside and a feeling of gaiety, crowded at first timidly into the anteroom, then hiding behind one another they pushed into the ballroom, where, shyly at first, and then more and more merrily and heartily, they started singing, dancing, and playing Christmas games. The Countess, when she had identified them and laughed at their costumes, went into the drawing-room. The Count sat in the ballroom, smiling radiantly and applauding the players. The young people had disappeared. Half an hour later, there appeared among the other mummers in the ballroom an old lady in a hooped skirt. This was Nicholas. A Turkish girl was Petya, a clown was Dimmler, an hussar was Natasha, and a Circassian was Sonia, with burnt cork moustache and eyebrows. After the condescending surprise, non-recognition, and praise from those who were not themselves dressed up, the young people decided that their costumes were so good that they ought to be shown elsewhere. Nicholas, who, as the roads were in splendid condition, wanted to take them all for a drive in his troika, proposed to take with him about a dozen of the serf mummers and to drive to Uncle's. "No, why disturb the old fellow?" said the Countess. "Besides, you wouldn't have room to turn round there. But you must go. Go to the Milyukovs." Milyukova was a widow who, with her family and their tutors and governesses, lived 3 miles from the Rostovs. "That's right, my dear," chimed in the old Count, thoroughly aroused. "I'll dress up at once and go with them. I'll make Pashette open her eyes." But the Countess would not agree to his going. He had had a bad leg all these last days. It was decided that the Count must not go, but that if Luisa Ivanovna, Madame Schoss, would go with them, the young ladies might go to the Melyukovs. Sonia, generally so timid and shy, more urgently than anyone begging Luisa Ivanovna not to refuse. Sonia's costume was the best of all. Her moustache and eyebrows were extraordinarily becoming. Everyone told her she looked very handsome, and she was in a spirited and energetic mood unusual with her. Some inner voice told her that now or never her fate would be decided, and in her male attire she seemed quite a different person. Luisa Ivanovna consented to go, and in half an hour 4 troika sleighs with large and small bells, their runners squeaking and whistling over the frozen snow, drove up to the porch. Natasha was foremost in setting a merry holiday tone, which, passing from one to another, grew stronger and stronger, and reached its climax when they all came out into the frost and got into the sleighs, talking, calling to one another, laughing and shouting. 2 of the troikas were the usual household sleighs. The 3rd was the old Count's, with a trotter from the Orlov stud as shaft horse. The 4th was Nicholas's own, with the short, shaggy black shaft horse. Nicholas, in his old lady's dress, over which he had belted his hussar overcoat, stood in the middle of the sleigh, reins in hand. It was so light that he could see the moonlight reflected from the metal harness discs and from the eyes of the horses, who looked round in alarm at the noisy party under the shadow of the porch roof. Natasha, Sonia, Madame Schoss, and 2 maids got into Nicholas's sleigh, Dimmler, his wife, and Petya into the old Count's, and the rest of the mummers seated themselves in the other 2 sleighs. "You go ahead, Zahar," shouted Nicholas to his father's coachman, wishing for a chance to race past him. The old Count's troika, with Dimmler and his party, started forward, squeaking on its runners as though freezing to the snow, its deep-toned bell clanging. The side horses, pressing against the shafts of the middle horse, sank in the snow, which was dry and glittered like sugar, and threw it up. Nicholas set off, following the 1st sleigh. Behind him, the others moved noisily, their runners squeaking. At first they drove at a steady trot along the narrow road. While they drove past the garden, the shadows of the bare trees often fell across the road and hid the brilliant moonlight. But as soon as they were past the fence, the snowy plain, bathed in moonlight and motionless, spread out before them, glittering like diamonds and dappled with bluish shadows. Bang, bang, went the 1st sleigh over a cradle hole in the snow of the road, and each of the other sleighs jolted in the same way, and, rudely breaking the frost-bound stillness, the troikas began to speed along the road, one after the other. "A hare's track,
A lot of tracks, rang out Natasha's voice through the frost-bound air. How light it is, Nicholas, came Sonya's voice. Nicholas glanced round at Sonya and bent down to see her face closer. Quite a new, sweet face with black eyebrows and moustaches peeped up at him from her sable furs, so close and yet so distant in the moonlight. That used to be Sonya, thought he, and looked at her closer and smiled. What is it, Nicholas? Nothing, said he, and turned again to the horses. When they came out onto the beaten high road, polished by sleigh runners and cut up by rough-shod hoofs, the marks of which were visible in the moonlight, the horses began to tug at the reins of their own accord and increased their pace. The near side horse, arching his head and breaking into a short canter, tugged at his traces. The shaft horse swayed from side to side, moving his ears as if asking, "Isn't it time to begin now?" In front, already far ahead, the deep bell of the sleigh ringing farther and farther off, the black horses driven by Zachar could be clearly seen against the white snow. From that sleigh one could hear the shouts, laughter, and voices of the mummers. "Gee up, my darlings!" shouted Nicholas, pulling the reins to one side and flourishing the whip. It was only by the keener wind that met them and the jerks given by the side horses who pulled harder, ever increasing their gallop, that one noticed how fast the troika was flying. Nicholas looked back. With screams, squeals, and waving of whips that caused even the shaft horses to gallop, the other sleighs followed. The shaft horse swung steadily beneath the bow over his head, with no thought of slackening pace, and ready to put on speed when required. Nicholas overtook the first sleigh. They were driving downhill and coming out upon a broad, trodden track across a meadow near a river. "Where are we?" thought he. "It's the Kosoy Meadow, I suppose. No, this is something new I've never seen before. This isn't the Kosoy Meadow nor the Jomkin Hill, and heaven only knows what it is. It's something new and enchanted. Well, whatever it may be." And shouting to his horses, he began to pass the first sleigh. Zahar held back his horses and turned his face, which was already covered with hoarfrost, to his eyebrows. Nicholas gave the horses the rein, and Zahar, stretching out his arms, clucked his tongue and let his horses go. "Now look out, master," he cried. Faster still the two troikas flew side by side, and faster moved the feet of the galloping side horses. Nicholas began to draw ahead. Zahar, while still keeping his arms extended, raised one hand with the reins. "No, you won't, master," he shouted. Nicholas put all his horses to a gallop and passed Zahar. The horses showered the fine dry snow on the faces of those in the sleigh. Beside them sounded quick ringing bells, and they caught confused glimpses of swiftly moving legs and the shadows of the troika they were passing. The whistling sound of the runners on the snow and the voices of girls shrieking were heard from different sides. Again checking his horses, Nicholas looked around him. They were still surrounded by the magic plain, bathed in moonlight and spangled with stars. "Zahar is shouting that I should turn to the left, but why to the left?" thought Nicholas. "Are we getting to the Milyukovs? Is this Milyukovka? Heaven only knows where we're going, and heaven knows what is happening to us, but it is very strange and pleasant, whatever it is." And he looked round in the sleigh. "Look, his moustache and eyelashes are all white," said one of the strange, pretty, unfamiliar people, the one with fine eyebrows and moustache. "I think this used to be Natasha," thought Nicholas. "And that was Madame Schoss, but perhaps it's not. And this Circassian with the moustache, I don't know, but I love her. Aren't you cold?" he asked. They did not answer, but began to laugh. Dimmler, from the sleigh behind, shouted something, probably something funny, but they could not make out what he said. "Yes, yes," some voices answered, laughing. But here was a fairy forest, with black moving shadows, and a glitter of diamond, and a flight of marble steps, and the silver roofs of fairy buildings, and the shrill yells of some animals. And if this is really Milyukovka, it is still stranger that we drove heaven knows where and have come to Milyukovka, thought Nicholas. It really was Milyukovka, and maids and footmen with merry faces came running out to the porch carrying candles.
"Who is it?"
asked someone in the porch.
"The mummers from the Count's, I know by the horses," replied some voices.
Chapter 11. At Milyukovka. Sonya goes to the barn to try her fortune. Pelageya Danilovna Milyukova a broadly built, energetic woman wearing spectacles, sat in the drawing room in a loose dress, surrounded by her daughters, whom she was trying to keep from feeling dull. They were quietly dropping melted wax into snow and looking at the shadows the wax figures would throw on the wall when they heard the steps and voices of new arrivals in the vestibule. Hussars, ladies, witches, clowns, and bears, after clearing their throats and wiping the hoarfrost from their faces in the vestibule, came into the ballroom where candles were hurriedly lighted. The clown, Dimmler, and the lady, Nicholas, started a dance. Surrounded by the screaming children, the mummers, covering their faces and disguising their voices, bowed to their hostess and arranged themselves about the room.
Dear me, there's no recognizing them. And Natasha, see whom she looks like. She really reminds me of somebody. But Herr Dimmler, isn't he good? I didn't know him, and how he dances. Dear me, there's a Circassian. Really, how becoming it is to dear Sonya. And who is that? Well, you have cheered us up. Nikita and Vanya, clear away the tables. And we were sitting so quietly. the hussar, just like a boy. And the legs. I can't look at him, different voices were saying.
Natasha, the young Melyukov's favorite, disappeared with them into the back rooms, where a cork and various dressing gowns and male garments were called for and received from the footman by bare, girlish hands from behind the door. 10 minutes later, all the young Melyukovs joined the mummers. Pelageya Danilovna, having given orders to clear the rooms for the visitors and arranged about refreshments for the gentry and the serfs, went about among the mummers without removing her spectacles, peering into their faces with a suppressed smile and failing to recognize any of them. It was not merely Dimmler and the Rostovs she failed to recognize. She did not even recognize her own daughters or her late husband's dressing gowns and uniforms which they had put on.
And who is this? She asked her governess, peering into the face of her own daughter dressed up as a Kazan Tartar. I suppose it is one of the Rostovs. Well, Mr. Hussar, and what regiment do you serve in? She asked Natasha. Here, hand some fruit jelly to the Turk, she ordered the butler who was handing things round. That's not forbidden by his law.
Sometimes, as she looked at the strange but amusing capers cut by the dancers, who, having decided once for all that being disguised no one would recognize them, were not at all shy, Pelageya Danilovna hid her face in her handkerchief, and her whole stout body shook with irrepressible, kindly, elderly laughter.
My little Sasha! Look at Sasha, she said.
After Russian country dances and chorus dances, Pelageya Danilovna made the serfs and gentry join in one large circle. A ring, a string, and a silver ruble were fetched, and they all played games together. In an hour, all the costumes were crumpled and disordered. The corked eyebrows and moustaches were smeared over the perspiring, flushed, and merry faces. Pelageya Danilovna began to recognize the mummers, admired their cleverly contrived costumes, and particularly how they suited the young ladies, and she thanked them all for having entertained her so well. The visitors were invited to supper in the drawing-room, and the serfs had something served to them in the ballroom.
Now, to tell one's fortune in the empty bathhouse is frightening, said an old maid who lived with the Melyukovs during supper.
Why? Said the eldest Melyukov girl.
You wouldn't go. It takes courage.
I'll go, said Sonya. Tell what happened to the young lady, said the second Melyukov girl.
Well, began the old maid, a young lady once went out, took a cock, laid the table for two, all properly, and sat down. After sitting a while, she suddenly hears someone coming. A sleigh drives up with harness bells. She hears him coming. He comes in just in the shape of a man, like an officer, comes in and sits down to table with her.
Ooh, ooh, screamed Natasha, rolling her eyes with horror.
Yes, and how did he speak? Yes, like a man. Everything quite all right, and he began persuading her. And she should have kept him talking till cockcrow, but she got frightened, just got frightened, and hid her face in her hands. Then he caught her up. It was lucky the maids ran in just then.
Now, why frighten them? Said Pelageya Danilovna.
Mama, you used to try your fate yourself, said her daughter.
And how does one do it in a barn? Inquired Sonya.
Well, say you went to the barn now and listened. It depends on what you hear.
Hammering and knocking, that's bad. But a sound of shifting grain is good, and one sometimes hears that, too. Mama, tell us what happened to you in the barn. Pelageya Danilovna smiled. Oh, I've forgotten, she replied. But none of you would go. Yes, I will. Pelageya Danilovna, let me. I'll go, said Sonya. Well, why not, if you're not afraid? Luisa Ivanovna, may I? Asked Sonya. Whether they were playing the ring and string game, or the ruble game, or talking as now, Nicholas did not leave Sonya's side, and gazed at her with quite new eyes. It seemed to him that it was only today, thanks to that burnt cork moustache, that he had fully learned to know her. And really, that evening, Sonya was brighter, more animated, and prettier than Nicholas had ever seen her before. So that's what she's like. What a fool I've been, he thought, gazing at her sparkling eyes. And under the moustache, a happy, rapturous smile dimpled her cheeks, a smile he had never seen before. I'm not afraid of anything, said Sonya. May I go at once? She got up. They told her where the barn was, and how she should stand and listen, and they handed her a fur cloak. She threw this over her head and shoulders and glanced at Nicholas. What a darling that girl is, thought he, and what have I been thinking of till now? Sonya went out into the passage to go to the barn. Nicholas went hastily to the front porch, saying he felt too hot. The crowd of people really had made the house stuffy. Outside, there was the same cold stillness and the same moon, but even brighter than before. The light was so strong and the snow sparkled with so many stars that one did not wish to look up at the sky and the real stars were unnoticed. The sky was black and dreary, while the earth was gay. I am a fool, a fool. What have I been waiting for? Thought Nicholas. And running out from the porch, he went round the corner of the house and along the path that led to the back porch. He knew Sonya would pass that way. Halfway lay some snow-covered piles of firewood, and across and along them a network of shadows from the bare old lime trees fell on the snow and on the path. This path led to the barn. The log walls of the barn and its snow-covered roof, that looked as if hewn out of some precious stone, sparkled in the moonlight. A tree in the garden snapped with the frost, and then all was again perfectly silent. His bosom seemed to inhale not air, but the strength of eternal youth and gladness. From the back porch came the sound of feet descending the steps. The bottom step upon which snow had fallen gave a ringing creak, and he heard the voice of an old maidservant saying, "Straight, straight along the path, miss. Only don't look back." "I'm not afraid," answered Sonya's voice. And along the path toward Nicholas came the crunching, whistling sound of Sonya's feet in her thin shoes. Sonya came along wrapped in her cloak. She was only a couple of paces away when she saw him. And to her, too, he was not the Nicholas she had known and always slightly feared. He was in a woman's dress, with tousled hair, and a happy smile new to Sonya. She ran rapidly toward him. Quite different, and yet the same, thought Nicholas, looking at her face all lit up by the moonlight. He slipped his arms under the cloak that covered her head, embraced her, pressed her to him, and kissed her on the lips that wore a moustache and had a smell of burnt cork. Sonya kissed him full on the lips, and disengaging her little hands, pressed them to his cheeks. "Sonya, Nicholas," was all they said. They ran to the barn, and then back again, re-entering he by the front and she by the back porch. Chapter 12. The drive home. Natasha and Sonya try the future with looking glasses. When they all drove back from Pelageya Danilovna's, Natasha, who always saw and noticed everything, arranged that she and Madame Schoss should go back in the sleigh with Dimmler and Sonya with Nicholas and the maids. On the way back, Nicholas drove at a steady pace instead of racing and kept peering by that fantastic, all-transforming light into Sonya's face and searching beneath the eyebrows and moustache for his former and his present Sonya, from whom he had resolved never to be parted again. He looked, and recognizing in her both the old and the new Sonya, and being reminded by the smell of burnt cork of the sensation of her kiss, inhaled the frosty air with a full breast,
and looking at the ground flying beneath him and at the sparkling sky, felt himself again in fairyland. "Sonya, is it well with thee?" he asked from time to time. "Yes," she replied, "and with thee?" When halfway home, Nicholas handed the reins to the coachman and ran for a moment to Natasha's sleigh and stood on its wing. "Natasha," he whispered in French, "do you know I've made up my mind about Sonya?" "Have you told her?" asked Natasha, suddenly beaming all over with joy. "Oh, how strange you are with that mustache and those eyebrows. Natasha, are you glad?" "I'm so glad, so glad. I was beginning to be vexed with you. I did not tell you, but you've been treating her badly. What a heart she has, Nicholas. I'm horrid sometimes, but I was ashamed to be happy while Sonya was not," continued Natasha. "Now I'm so glad. Well, run back to her." "No, wait a bit. Oh, how funny you look," cried Nicholas, peering into her face and finding in his sister, too, something new, unusual, and bewitchingly tender that he had not seen in her before. "Natasha, it's magical, isn't it?" "Yes," she replied. "You've done splendidly." Had I seen her before as she is now, thought Nicholas, I should long ago have asked her what to do and have done whatever she told me, and all would have been well.
"So you're glad, and I've done right?"
"Oh, quite right. I had a quarrel with Mama some time ago about it. Mama said she was angling for you. How could she say such a thing? I nearly stormed at Mama. I will never let anyone say anything bad of Sonya, for there is nothing but good in her."
"Then it's all right?" said Nicholas, again scrutinizing the expression of his sister's face to see if she was in earnest. Then he jumped down, and his boots scrunching the snow, ran back to his sleigh. The same happy, smiling Circassian, with mustache and beaming eyes looking up from under a sable hood, was still sitting there. And that Circassian was Sonya, and that Sonya was certainly his future happy and loving wife. When they reached home and had told their mother how they had spent the evening at the Milyukovs', the girls went to their bedroom. When they had undressed, but without washing off the cork mustaches, they sat a long time talking of their happiness.